M&A is a muscle. You have to work the muscle. And to do M&A, you need capital. So you need to work the muscle of raising and having capital readily available.
What does M&A look like it's doing to you in the Australian market?
I think we've built some amazing businesses. I think we've exported some amazing businesses. I think that's given the market a credibility that it probably hasn't had previously. The reason I pause is the SaaSpocalypse side of it. We haven't really spoken about that.
SaaSpocalypse, is that a new term? Did I miss when that term was coined?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, 3, 2, 1.
Hey, I'm Cheryl.
I'm Maxine.
This is First Check, part of Day One, the network dedicated to founders, operators, and investors.
If you want to be a better early stage investor, this is the show for you.
So TLDR, if you don't want to suck at investing, listen up.
So Maxine, I heard that the IPO markets are a little bit closed for companies as an exit option, except if you're like Canva or one of them. So the reality is that most of our portfolio companies are going to have to look at the M&A market for exits for us. It's not really something that we're talking about very much as investors. Do you think we should maybe talk to somebody about that?
I feel like we should probably talk to someone about that. I feel like the perfect person to talk to about that is someone who has both operated and done M&A inside of organizations. Do you know anyone?
That would be perfect. I think I do.
Drum roll. Enter Alex. So Alex is the founder of a company called Tiger and Bear, which is an M&A advisory. They do both sell side and buy side advisory, specifically in the tech ecosystem. But more relevantly, he operated at Amaysim and executed this strategy for them during 2020 and 2021. They bought and sold a bunch of different businesses to build a dominant player in the Australian ecosystem and then ultimately sold it. And I feel like he takes M&A craft to the next level. He writes a lot about it. He thinks a lot about M&A strategy, specifically in tech and innovation. And so he could be an amazing person.
He sounds perfect. Should we jump into it with him then?
Let's do it.
You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
If you're a founder or operator trying to scale, here's the reality. Australian hiring is getting harder, salaries are at record highs, and the talent you need is increasingly out of reach. The best operators are quietly building offshore teams of engineers, marketers, accountants, and analysts at a fraction of the cost.
Peartree does it differently. They headhunt highly skilled talent from the Philippines and South Africa with full transparency on where every dollar goes, so your team is paid fairly, and they are fully focused on your business.
As a Day One listener, you'll receive a free team audit to identify where offshore talent could move the needle in your business. Plus, 20% off on your first hire.
You can learn more at day1.fm/peartree. That's day1.fm/peartree.
Well, really excited to get into it. Welcome, Alex. We are pumped to chat all things M&A with you. But before we get into that, we always ask our guests the same first question. And I'm super excited to hear your answer. What is the very first thing that you ever invested in?
Hey, legends. Thanks for having me. So the first thing I ever invested in was the BHP Rio Tinto merger. I had just set up my share trading account in the early teens, whenever that was. And I read the headlines, got excited by these two big businesses coming together. I had no idea what I was doing. I dusted all of my cash in that transaction. Obviously, the merger never happened. I bought at the peak. Both of them collapsed. There was a bit of a mining lull thereafter. And not long after that was some hiccups in the global financial system as well. So between all of that, that was an awesome experience because I learned just how little I actually knew about what on earth I was doing.
Brutal.
Oh, brutal. How bad did you feel at the end of that?
I felt awful, but it was an awesome experience in hindsight. I really needed that money at the time, but so be it.
How many years has it been since? It feels awesome now.
It feels awesome now. It took a little bit of time to lick my wounds and get over it. And I really remember, I remember reading all the headlines, remember getting excited about them, remember chatting to my father-in-law about share trading and sort of learning about what it meant and how to do it. And to be frank, we both got excited by the idea. I just went all in. And I think he had the the sense not to go all in on that trade.
Amazing, amazing. I will say nothing educates the mind quite like a complete lighting of one's capital on fire. Really focuses the mind on the learning opportunities.
What a great analogy. A complete lighting of one's capital on fire. You just brought sophistication to that.
I love that it's like completely on brand, right? Because now you support companies in M&As. The fact that your first ever investment was into an M&A.
And an absolute dud.
An absolute dud of an M&A, nonetheless.
I'm kind of surprised you still went into M&A after that. You were like, I'm going to invest in M&A. The M&A didn't happen. You know what? I'm going to go do M&A for a career.
I mean, maybe the irony is that it taught me how little I knew. And so maybe there's a part of me that is still trying to work out what on earth it means and how to do it well and how to pick winners, right? How to invest in things, whether that's using your time or your capital or combination into things that are more likely to succeed than not. But probably also not losing that excitement factor to swing for the fence occasionally on something that might just be a bit out there, but still worth trying.
And I mean, from what I understand of your career, you've done quite a lot of that, right? Some like pretty brave M&A. You've built a lot of value in a lot of companies through M&A, which we'll get into in a moment. But I think the first place that I'd love to start is you are obviously so steeped in M&A in the Australian ecosystem. You like deeply understand it. You spend all of your time in that space now through Tiger and Bear. And then prior to that, you know, in your operating roles at Maysim and its various conglomerations. I feel like I'm sitting here in the ecosystem as it is today in what feels like unprecedented, or I don't think it's unprecedented. There was a single other time that felt as volatile, and that was COVID to me, but like nearly unprecedented volatility. I feel like every day I'm like, what is it going to be today? Like, which outrageous kind of substrate shifting move is going to happen today?
Which thing is going to implode today?
And so where I'd like to start is just kind of doing M&A in environments of volatility. And I think you might be one of the best people in Australia to talk about this, because you were buying and selling under a Maysim's brand in 2021, like during the pandemic. So can you maybe educate us a little bit, like how do you think about buying and selling businesses when the market is doing crazy stuff around you?
That is a huge question. And it, as the like the probably the last bit really we should chat about, how do you do M&A in a fully locked down remote environment? That was an absolute first for me, because we ran three transactions at the same time across 2020, 2021 in a full lockdown environment with three deal teams going, an army of support, support infrastructure. And that was really, really unique and very special that we were able to pull it off. But, you know, the funny thing is, only thing that really feels different about today is, and I saw this in an artwork, and so I'm quoting someone else who's far smarter than me.
Are you quoting it like motivational poster from your office, Alex?
No. No, I'm not. I'm quoting an artist. I won't name the artist, but the artist said, we are in a post-truth world. And that artist said that about 5 or 6 years ago, which I think is really, incredibly insightful, because today I say that out loud, it probably feels obvious, even though we don't talk about it as much as we probably should. But at the time she said that, it was a really unique statement. But actually the volatility we're experiencing today, I don't know that it's that unique, right? So I was investing and working in M&A during the GFC, and that was incredibly volatile. Then COVID was incredibly volatile, and we're in another phase of volatility. I don't know that this one is all that different to the previous iterations that I've encountered. And so I say that from a position of, I hope that gives folks solace, right, in the sense that this isn't that different. Those that have got the muscle and that have exercised that muscle over time probably aren't finding this all that different. The pace has changed. There are thing characteristics that have changed about the way the markets operate today, but the fundamentals are still the same. The key to any M&A activity is timing. And all that's become more challenging is trying to work out how to get your timing right in a faster paced environment is just more difficult, because your windows of opportunity are a lot tighter. In the past, you'd have maybe multi-year periods of stability, maybe multi-6-month block periods of stability. And at the moment, and particularly with the way that Trump's America runs, things do change very, very quickly. But actually, the rest of the world still moves at roughly the same pace. If you think about the European capital markets, you think about the Asian and Australian capital markets, we're kind of the same to what we used to do. We just do it a bit faster. America's a bit of an outlier. And so I think it's really easy to get caught up in there in how much of an outlier they are. But if we step back from what happens over there, actually the rest of the world is a bit more stable. And then timing is really important to think about both from two very different perspectives. The timing, the timing considerations for a seller versus the timing considerations for a buyer, they're just wildly different, right? For a seller, what you're trying to do is you're trying to line everything ready for a sale, but then having an amazing backup plan so you don't actually have to execute on the sale, you're not forced to, right? What you don't want to do is you don't want to be in a forced position, because then timing could work incredibly against you. If you have a great fallback plan and you're just operating to the fallback plan, but you're ready, then timing the market, it probably isn't that hard. What you're looking for is these moments of stability, and you're trying to not transact in moments of instability. And the only reason the instability is an issue is, from a buyer's perspective, if you're not quite sure what the cost of capital is, you're probably going to just hesitate. And that's the crux, right? So it's not about rising markets, like rising interest rate markets or falling interest rate markets. It's not about the movement. It's about the uncertainty of where it's going to end up. And once that uncertainty of where it's going to finish passes, then everyone can price risk and price capital and therefore get deals done. From a buyer's perspective, it's about lining up all of your stakeholders and getting ready for opportunistic buying. And so you're looking for the inverse. You're looking for those moments where the thing you really wanted, and that unpacks a different question, which is how on earth do you know what you want? But if you knew what you really wanted and knew that you were buying for the right reason or for a really logical reason, then it's about lining up all of the capabilities you need to be able to transact and then just waiting and being really patient with it, and not getting white line fever on the first thing that pops up. But I think the key that I see people do the least is that prep work, especially for a buyer, around what on earth would I buy if I could buy anything and in what order?
Totally. Yeah. So I want to get into that, because I think that that is like such a common failure mode for the companies that in, especially like early stage and like late stage tech companies, is kind of like opportunistic buying as opposed to a strategic buying. But it sounds to me like in the volatility scenario, actually, like the probability that those peaks line up is higher because both markets are changing, right? Like a seller's market is changing and a buyer's market is changing. And then ideally, like in a much more stable environment, those two opportunity sets just aren't lining up, and like they line up or they don't. Whereas in volatility, they're constantly moving, right? Cost of capital is moving, like opportunity is moving.
And yeah, you may find that's right. And then it depends on what that volatility does to your segment, right? In some segments, the volatility flushes folks to the surface.
True.
And then if you then think about it from a buyer's perspective, the fishing is easier if you can see the fish. Whereas if you think about it in a market where it sends everyone down to the bottom of the ocean, everyone kind of sits and waits submarine style, much harder to identify your target and to be able to execute on it. Particularly if you are opportunistic, where you haven't already got a plan and lasered in on your ideal target.
Super interesting. I wonder, in a kind of seller, for on the sell side of this, right, especially in like tech and venture, how many companies are you seeing in this current market actually starting to sell or think about selling? Like, how many of them are actually floating to the top versus sinking to the bottom in that analogy?
The reason I pause is the SaaSpocalypse side of it. We haven't really spoken about that.
SaaSpocalypse, is that a new term? Did I miss when that term was coined?
Yeah, for sure.
It's a term. Yeah, it's definitely a term. Yeah.
It is the market reaction to Claude 4.6. Sorry, yes, Opus 4.6. When Opus 4.6 came out, well, actually, Alex, I'm so interested to hear your thoughts on this, because I found myself being like the market completely freaked out. I think Microsoft wrote down 35% in 2 days. Like, it was bad. And everyone was like, guys, AI is going to automate jobs. And from my seat, I was like, what game have you guys been watching? Like, 3 years. And the operators in these companies like, we're going to automate your jobs. We are, in fact, going to automate your jobs. Hey, guys, we're going to automate your jobs. And the market was like, yeah, whatever, whatever.
Tomorrow, we're definitely going to automate your jobs.
And then 4.6 comes out and they're like, oh my God, they're automating our job.
You never told us.
Yeah. Why didn't you tell me you were going to automate my job?
You know, the part that the capital market probably reacted most to is, could you rebuild all of these businesses from scratch? You've always theoretically could, but could you now do it from your laptop? Could I now rebuild WiseTech from my laptop, and all of a sudden WiseTech is no longer a valuable business? The reason I raise that is, well, firstly, Cheryl, to educate you on a whole new term, but the other reason is that has meant that there are a bunch of technology businesses out there right now who are thinking, actually, it's probably not a great time for me to be selling because my natural buyer is really struggling. And if my natural buyer is really struggling, so imagine you were building something that was logistics focused and you thought that WiseTech was your natural buyer. I'm picking on them because they're obvious, they're acquisitive, and they're really well known in market. Just as an example, well, their share price is at 30 odd bucks at the moment from its 100 plus peak. You probably sitting there looking at them going, oh, they're still a fabulous business.
They're probably not going to buy me anytime soon.
But at least if they did, their relative values have shifted quite significantly, right? What was one of their sort of levers to acquire assets was Scrip. And so all of a sudden the Scrip is just a lot less valuable. The odds that they're willing to do a Scrip-based deal today are simply lower than they used to be because of the value of the Scrip. And so all of a sudden one of the levers has disappeared, which just means things are a bit more difficult to get done. The great irony is their Scrip probably goes up from here, right? And so you probably would really, really like it, but they'd be disinclined to give it to you.
Right. It'd be extremely dilutive, which actually probably is worthwhile me naming Scrip here. Essentially what that means is you get stock, you don't get money, right? For those folks who are not particularly familiar, who are listening, who are not particularly familiar with M&A.
Like, you would get shares.
You get shares.
Share-based consideration.
Yes. The technical term.
So to come back to your question, do I think there are folks waiting on the sidelines? Yes. Overall, I don't think we've seen a material pullback in activity. At the end of the day, the venture industry, as in the capital side of venture, has created incredible amounts of businesses. The whole premise of the venture capital market is you've got to cycle assets. You cannot sit on them forever for a range of reasons, not least of which is that you need money to invest in the next fund and to invest in the next asset. And so there is a lot of pressure to move things on and not hold on to them forever. And so I think that pressure, the existence of those businesses, the need to move capital, people's desires and personal aspirations, all of that creates a dynamic where you can't not be a seller. And so therefore, there are sellers in market. But frankly, if you didn't have to sell right now, you'd probably want to hold on for a little bit, particularly if you were not as exposed to the SaaSpocalypse style thinking, right? So if your business could be recreated really easily, you'd probably be really anxious right now. But if your business can't be easily recreated, and particularly was deeply integrated into your customers, probably want to hold on for a bit longer.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, if I think about, especially M&A markets, they seem to be, as you said, like, in the data that they have been responding, actually, very, like, they are unperturbed by the SaaSpocalypse and similar dynamics, right? I think I saw that we are up on a deal value basis this year versus last year in the Australian ecosystem. And interestingly, more of that coming in from overseas. So you mentioned there, like, the US is a beast unto itself, right? Trump's America operates in a completely different way. Has that changed behavior into the Australian ecosystem? Is that driving? Because I think I saw, you know, like 45% or something of our M&A market is coming international investors, when it was like 30 something last year.
More than half of our last dozen deals were overseas capital, not American.
Overseas, not American. Interesting. What are the dominant geos that capital is coming from?
Europe and Asia.
Fascinating.
Acquiring Australian companies?
Yeah. Europe, Asia coming into Australia. Combination of tech and services businesses and far less so from America, at least in the microcosm that we get to see day to day.
Right. Yeah. That's fascinating.
And that kind of makes sense, right? If you're American right now, just the risk profile of moving capital out and the uncertainty of what happens domestically with, I don't know, even basic things like just tariffs on respective countries and that tit-for-tat style warfare that's going on. Do you really want to get exposed to that if you didn't have to?
Yeah. I also think there's probably a lot of domestic opportunities, right? Like if you have a capital advantage in the US at the moment, there's lots of assets that are
locally that you can take advantage of rather than having to look overseas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the signal. Like, I mean, that's the policy signal you're being sent over there, right? So today you're being sent, if you're in America, that is, you're being sent the signal of invest domestically and we'll give you breaks from tax as an example, whereas invest overseas and you might get punished. Again, if you didn't have to, you'd just think local instead of global.
Yeah. Which I guess is the like policy incentive that they've got going on at the moment.
That's kind of the point, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. That's working.
And it's working, right? It's doing exactly what it doesn't, whether we agree with it or not, it's definitely working.
Well, their loss.
What are you seeing in the Australian market in the kind of version that you get to see? Like, what does M&A look like to you, noting that you get a really kind of unique tech and services perspective? What does M&A look like it's doing to you in the Australian market?
I think we've built some amazing businesses. I think we've exported some amazing businesses. And I think that's given the market a credibility that it probably hasn't had previously. I think there's more of a belief that an Aussie business can be an export asset that can go global. And it's you know, full credit to the Canvas and Atlassians and the Ukes of the world and many others and their wallets that have created that platform of credibility on top of an existing ecosystem. So I think that's been really great. There are plenty of businesses actually making money, and that's really, really powerful. And it's powerful because it buys time. That's the most valuable part of that that sort of characteristic of a business. And the flow-on effects of its profitable venture businesses are also more likely to be picked up by a strategic because then they're non-earnings dilutive, right? One of the big sort of fears is that a strategic turns around and says, I love what you've built, but you're losing money every month and I can't buy this because I get measured on a profit multiple and you want to be measured on a revenue multiple. And that divergence is just a bridge too far. So seeing Aussie tech and service businesses get themselves into a state of profitability or a state of being break-even when they're not reliant on more capital, I think it's really, really powerful. I think it gives them more options. I think it gives them more time. I think it makes them more attractive to strategic money. And I want to emphasize the strategic money thing because the IPO market has been dead for a while. The ASX has frankly done nothing, notwithstanding the headlines, which are full of crap, to spur more interest in it. I mean, they've had, you could name the IPOs that are meaningful on one hand over the last few years, and that's really, really sad. So one of the core tools of creating value from a venture was to potentially list that venture. That tool has entirely disappeared. And that emphasis, therefore, on strategic capital is just much more important because it means that if you think about, like, where do I take my business? Well, I take it to a strategic or I take it to private equity. Those are my only two pathways. A third got closed. Therefore, thinking about what a strategic might be interested in is really valuable. And of the businesses we see, if I'd sort of reflect 5 years ago, most Aussie tech businesses were not thinking about being profitable. Fast forward to today, that is a standard part of the conversation. In the first pitch meeting, you're going to hear, this is what my revenue's done, this is my sort of size of market, this is what I'm chasing, and by the way, I'm break even or I'm profitable. And I think it's a really, really healthy shift.
Yeah, super interesting.
Founders scale faster on Deel. Set up payroll for any country in minutes, hire anyone anywhere, and get visas handled fast so you stay focused on scaling. Deel takes care of onboarding, HR, IT, EOR, benefits, and compliance so your team can grow without borders. It's why more than 40,000 fast-growing companies trust Deel to move fast. Visit deel.com/day1. That's deel.com/day1.
Maybe kind of for my context and our audience's context, when is a company big enough to start to acquire other businesses? And when is a company too small to be acquired? Like, what does that valley of death look like between those two ecosystems?
Then I'm going to avoid giving, I'm going to avoid giving numeric answers because it's so sector and product dependent. As an example, you could be making no money, but you could have an amazing sort of R&D patented idea that someone says, hey, I just want to buy that. And that is of value to me because I'm a big strategic that has power lines and I want to buy a widget that helps my power lines be better. And I'm happy to pay for that because it just saves me time and effort. So you could get a business that's purchasable for things other than the financial metrics. But the typical rule of thumb, and I'm about to break my own promise, which is not to give metrics.
That's what we're here for. We're here for the numbers.
If you are sub 10 mil of revenue, a strategic will find that really, really small. And therefore, the love factor they need to identify in your asset is just a lot higher. And what I mean is they're not buying it for the numbers. Therefore, they must be buying it exclusively for some other characteristic. And they're just so deeply in love with the technology that you've created or the brand that you've created. That's possible, and that happens, but that's less probable. The more probable is that they like the thing you've built, maybe even love it, but they also love your numbers, or at least they like your numbers, or at least your numbers aren't a detractor. So if you then play that out, what does that mean? So let's say you're a 300 mil market cap listed strategic. That's not particularly big in the Aussie market, but it's definitely not a small business either. To spin up a Deel team to run out an asset that's worth, let's say in revenue terms, sub 10 million bucks, the cost of that Deel team relative to what else they could be looking at might make that Deel almost cost prohibitive to do in the absence of them being in love with it for some other reason. So I think that's really important. And then from a buyer's perspective, it depends what you're buying for. So if you're buying for bulk, then I'd say a good litmus test is, could you borrow money? If you could borrow money, that means you have enough operating profit in your business to sustain debt. And if you can use that form of capital to buy bulk, to buy scale into your organization, you are much more likely to create value, rent equity value for your existing shareholders than just using an equity injection for that type of transaction. If you're buying for reach, if you're buying for some strategic component, if you're buying the missing piece in the puzzle, maybe debt raising ability is a less relevant metric. Maybe there are other metrics to use, like, you know, simply how big is the thing relative to you. And then the other interesting thing we see in these, and you described it earlier, the sort of these volatile market moments, if you happen to get your timing such that your big strategics are not that interested because it's in the height of volatility, it's a height of uncertainty, what we tend to see is more mergers of equals, more businesses that are similar shaped coming together because they're not being purchased, but they still need to do things. They still need to change their business. They still need to try and break out of their status quo. And if capital markets get a little bit weaker, if buying activity gets a little bit weaker in their particular segment, and we saw this during COVID and we saw this during the GFC, businesses that are similar shape, similar size, coming together saying we'd be more powerful together, and we don't have to buy each legally one of them has to buy the other, but in commercial terms, we can smash these two things together, extract some value, and be bigger through this difficult time.
We've seen a bunch of that in the last like 12 months in the venture ecosystem specifically, right? Like that makes sense in this market where we're seeing people who are looking at this and going, actually, we made some bets during like 2021 to 2022 that maybe the market isn't as big. What did we see? Like me and you and
Mr. Yum.
Mr. Yum come together.
That's the one I had in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was actually thinking we see a surprising, like, really small amount of that happening in the venture ecosystem. And maybe it's a maturity thing in the Australian ecosystem. Like, we just happen to have had the two biggest players in QR code ordering globally that were domiciled out of Australia competing against each other. And so that felt like it was like it was a merger that made more sense. But I think historically, the Australian ecosystem has been not deep enough that there is those kinds of mergers. But even if I think about in the US, right, like growth stage businesses, that's not a lever you see a lot in the tech ecosystem of them merging together. Or maybe I'm just blanking on examples.
I think they're just less advertised.
Interesting.
Do you have more examples for us?
Do, but in many of those cases, they don't really want it advertised that two businesses came together, because that's not, those transactions are not perceived as coming from a place of strength. They're perceived as coming from a place of weakness. Because what you're ultimately saying is, I needed to do something about the capital structure of the business. I needed to do something with the business. And it wasn't run organically, and it wasn't sell to a big strategic and get a great headline number and be able to advertise my deal. And so often they just go under the radar.
Yeah, I think it's often not seen as like a success, right? Like if you're an investor in Mr. Yum, and it wasn't necessarily like, yeah, amazing, we got this big exit. Like as an investor, you're not really seeing that as a huge win in terms of portfolio. Like sometimes it's good script for script, but more often than not, it's not seen as.
But that doesn't help the and why not? Because it doesn't help the underlying challenge, which is funds put money into those businesses, and those the LPs and the funds need their money back to be able to invest in other things. They can't just sit there and be stuck forever. On the one hand, that the pitch is, well, I just rolled my equity from one stuck private position into another stuck private position.
Yeah.
That's not a sexy story, even if the underlying core of the business got better in the process.
Yeah.
I think, Maxine, maybe the other reason we probably see a little bit less of it here is, I think the venture funds have actually been pretty good at not backing lots of identical things.
Yeah, well, I think they can't.
That's true. Like we often see that. Well, yeah, like we'll see the big funds will say things like, oh, we've invested in this and they plan to do something similar in the future, so we can't even touch you, which I think is not the same. Like Maxine, maybe you can add a bit of color there, but I don't recall hearing a lot of that in the US, whereas I hear our funds say a lot more of that here. Is it?
Yeah, there is at the fund level. And I think it is largely driven from a belief that in most markets, to create the kind of outcome that they are trying to create for their funds, they need to be in the inverted commas top company, right? And so they can't really, from a mandate perspective or from an ego perspective, be like, we were in the top company and now we're also in this other top company, right? Like it's a ranking thing. So if they're like, okay, we allocated to this one and then we're going to allocate to this second top company, they're effectively being like, we got the first one wrong. The only people that don't, that are different in the way that they do this, but I'm aware of, is A16. A16 approaches it where they will invest in a particular thematic and take multiple positions around the thematic if they're really convicted on it, because they're trying to invest the thematic and then they try and pick the best company in like various strategies in that thematic. Like an example would be, the one that comes to mind is like,
is it the Silicon Valley one where like it's Peter Thiel being like, yeah, you're just one of our middle out plays?
No, that is not the example that came to mind.
That was the example that came into my mind.
Yes, yes. The example that comes to mind is like the horizontal play versus the vertical play. So they might believe that there is a particular platform shift that's happening, and they might invest in like Bland, which is like, let's say voice AI is the new interface. And they will invest in Bland as a horizontal play across the entire voice interface transition as a picks and shovels business in that transition. And then they will invest in like Spectre and like a bunch of the tools that are specifically using voice AI in a vertical, right? And so they're kind of covering both from different angles. Whereas in Australia, they would be more likely to be like, sorry, we're horizontally invested, so we're just like out if we think there's going to be competition. But I think that's a depth of market.
And I think at Aussie VC funds, I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that if there was already a great portfolio company in one of the funds and you had a terrific pitch of a similar business, but with your own nuances, and you went to another fund knowing that the first fund wouldn't back you because they already have exposure, I suspect that the second fund you'd go to would say, well, how are you different to them? Am I just building a competitor to someone who is already in the sector that you know, they have a head start on what you'd be building? I think there'd be some reticence to back something that is a direct competitor to something that already exists in a venture market that isn't, that's good, and it's become a lot bigger and a lot better, a lot more vibrant than it's been in the past, but still is a reasonably small market.
Totally. Yeah, I think that's right. They'd prefer to try and just get in on that company, the one that's doing well, than try to back a competitor like 2 years, 3 years later. Which I think actually overall, saying it out loud, maybe that's not true, but I don't think that's an optimal strategy, right? Like Australia, because we are a feeder ecosystem into the US, sizing these markets domestically as opposed to sizing them globally and believing that there could be two winners.
I don't know. The one part of the reticence that I appreciate is just because you could build a great business in Australia doesn't mean that your business will work in the US. The US isn't one market, whereas Australia is one pretty homogenous market. And so the mistake I see over and over is, oh, I made it work in Australia, let me go raise some money to go to the US. And the problem statement then gets broken into a couple of components. The first is Aussie funds don't usually write the sort of checks you need to be able to go to the US.
Conveniently forgetting that the US is a whole bunch of different states.
Yeah, it's like 50 different economies with their own nuances, and they're not just nuances, they're quite significant differences, right? Good luck telling a Texan person that they're pretty similar to a Californian person. That's a great way to start a war. And because they're so different, the capital you need to be able to attack those markets is so different. I don't know that the Aussie capital market is right for that. There are very few that would play in that, I'm going to take this business offshore with enough capital to really make it work. And the feedback you get from American funds is, but you're not here yet. You haven't got traction in the American market, so we're not going to give you money. Why don't you come over here, prove yourself, and then we'll give you some money. And of course, that you get stuck in that catch 22. So whilst I think we could be a much better feeder market to global markets, I don't know that we are great at that today.
I think it's nuanced, right? Like, I think that that is true for large established companies. Like if you're Series B and you're trying to do, or C, and you're trying to do expansion to the US at that point, it's super hard. If you're doing it at seed, not hard, right? You just like build that DNA super early in.
Yeah, a lot of our portfolio companies are just like, I'm going to book a trip. I'm going to the US this week. And all of our customers are already in the US. So we may as well just like go spend some time there.
Totally.
Agreed. I think it's stage dependent. Like if you're just doing it early stage, super casual, then it just grows organically from there. And then all of your customers are there. Then it's a lot, like it's just a lot less of a hassle later on. You're not really expanding. You're just putting up some operations.
And those are founder-led sales in each of those examples, right? And there's a core difference between that, right? The founder's getting remunerated in lots of different ways, not just the salary, whereas what happens in later stage businesses, there's so rarely founder-led sales. And the classic is, oh, well, I've done it in Australia and I've done it through this particular sales motion, including the group of people that do that. I'm going to go hire my group of people in America. And more often than not, that leads to a dusting of capital. that same image that we started with of the dollar bill being burnt.
Yeah. It's super hard growth stage, like expanding with that DNA. So I'd love to pull on one of the threads you mentioned here as you're kind of like telling us what you're seeing in the Australian market. You wrote an amazing piece, which I think is awesome, about like how to not just opportunistically be like, oh, I'm just going to invest in this company because it arrived, right? As a growth stage business or larger business, be like, look at that. I met this company.
Like when babies land on your doorstep.
Yeah, you should keep them. So I'm wondering if you can kind of run us through that framework a little bit. Like, how do you advise companies to actually prepare to be a high quality buyer, especially for kind of growth stage tech companies? Because my observation is there is an accelerating number of companies that are starting to meet that kind of middle company stage where actually they're inorganically growing, meaning they're buying other companies in order to accelerate their growth. And I'd love to just open source for early stage investors who are listening and maybe founders how to think about actually doing that strategically as opposed to the version where you obliterate a bunch of capital.
Awesome. M&A is a muscle. You have to work the muscle. And if you think about what that means, there is to do M&A, you need capital. So you need to work the muscle of raising and having capital readily available. The most likely reason for a deal to fall over is you haven't yet got the money. You think you'll get it and you're trying to raise and do the deal at the same time. That is a recipe for disaster. Getting those timelines to align. Sure, maybe, but odds on you won't. And there'll be a mismatch, and that mismatch will either mean you'll end up with too much capital and no transaction, or a fabulous transaction that you don't have the capital for. So you've got to work that muscle. You've got to work the muscle on the capital side. You've got to work the internal muscle. You've got to get your team bought into the idea that we will be buying stuff as a growth lever. And I say that, and it is such a not natural movement for a business that started with a founder-led sales motion. And then the second person was probably similar to the founder-led sales motion, and the third person, and so on. And these businesses have grown through this organic movement, which is just great, and it works, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just very different to M&A. Everything you have done is your own, and now you have to look at the way someone else does it, and you have to suspend that moment where you go, well, mine is better than theirs, therefore I'll never be able to buy them, or I shouldn't buy them, or I want to buy them and break it all into pieces, without that lens of, but actually they did a really good job here, they just did it differently, and how do I put that together? And that leads me to the third part of it, which is, even if you got the capital right and you had the internal muscle and the buy-in and your emotion is good, the integration is what makes and breaks the question of, did it make you money? If you didn't integrate it well, and well means different for different businesses and different situations, there are some things that shouldn't be integrated. There are some things that should be tightly integrated from the very beginning. But if you don't do that well, you just end up as a loose collection of brands and systems and business units, often with no synergy extraction and no industrial logic for them to coexist. And if what you're trying to do is build one unified business, you have failed. If you wanted to build a conglomerate of brands, you've succeeded. It's just often not what people are setting out to do. So it's that constant motion, and it's being ready at all points in time to be able to transact. And then the last part of that is, why are you doing it? And so few businesses, and that's probably one of the reasons we exist, are able to internally describe why it is that they would do a particular deal. And then even the million harder question is, if you had two deals to do, which one would you pick? And you can't say, I'm going to do both. So you've got to pick one, and you've got to transact it, and then you've got to integrate it. And it's almost impossible to do two at the same time. And so stack ranking forces you to come to that articulation of, why am I doing this one? What's special about this one? And why is this the right order in which to do it? So being really conscious about that planning process to say, this is the one I need. And once I do this one, it'll unlock this further chain of activity. Some of it might be organic. Some of it might be inorganic. And being able to answer that really crisply.
One of the things that strikes me there is actually like on the buy side, having like if you're a company buying these businesses, actually, a necessary precondition is that you understand the levers of your business sufficient that you can answer okay, if I buy this business, it drives this lever.
Or it's going to turn this one.
Yeah. Or if I buy this business, it's going to turn this one, which almost necessitates that we're talking about Series B plus businesses. Actually, in this market, it's often like Series C and later.
You need to be much more mature. You need to have a really good understanding of what your business is before buying makes any sense.
So are you saying like absolutely no opportunistic? Because I've like a lot of our portfolio companies, I feel like are like from your conversation now, I'm thinking like, man, all our portfolio companies that were thinking about buying things are probably actually way too early to start buying things. And maybe next time they come to me and say, hey, we want to buy this, I should be like, maybe not. Like, are you saying there's no scenario where the baby lands on your doorstep and you're like, this is a great baby, let's bring it inside?
Not at all. No. There's opportunistic deals can be fabulous, but you're often going to be backfilling. They're probably slightly less likely to generate the return you thought they would than the highly disciplined deal. And the reason I say that is because when it lands, what will naturally happen is if you're really disciplined, you'll still do the exercise that I described, which is trying to work out why you're going to do a deal and what you're buying it for, and you'll do all of those component parts of the muscle, but you probably have confirmation bias. And you're probably going to convince yourself that some of those reasons are a bit more important than others. And through that confirmation bias, odds on, you're going to eat away at little bits of value in that chain. And that doesn't mean that you might not stumble upon something that's fabulous and just happens to beautifully fit. And it's, it's literally the universe is aligning. But statistically, more likely that you've picked it because it landed on your doorstep, and then you're going to grab it and there'll be bits that don't fit and you haven't yet thought through what you're going to do with the ill-fitting components. There are two sorts of decisions you have to make in every transaction when you buy something. There are bits that the other side does better than you, and there are bits that you do better than them. Ironically, it's where you do things better than them is the easy decision, because all you're going to do is you're going to go, that's broken, this works, I'm going to apply this to that. And hopefully you don't break their culture in the process. Let's assume you don't. But when they do things better than you, do you really have it in you to go, that's awesome, I should probably let my version of that go and let them, the business that I'm acquiring, run that for me or do that for me or inherit their bit and throw my bit out? And there are lots of examples where this goes wrong, but it's ultimately a human question, right? Are you willing to put ego aside and let objectivity drive? And imagine you come to two engineering teams, both who have slaved away at a particular product or a particular way of doing things, and you have to say to one of those teams, your way of doing it is good, but theirs is better. We're going to put yours in the bin. We're going to apply theirs. And we'd love you to be bought into the integration project of torching your thing and using their thing. And you might pull that off, but you can see how difficult that is, because you are telling someone that there's a prettier baby out there.
Totally. It's super hard, especially when you're being competitors. Like on the merger scenario, I saw this quite close. Because my partner was working at Mr. Yum, like the fight between me and you and Mr. Yum, and then having to merge those two, it would be like merging like Microsoft and Intel in the late 1990s. They had played SmackDown for years.
Like last week we were competing, today we got to figure out how to work together.
Yeah. And to Alex's point, like also torching certain bits and like integrating certain bits. So my hat goes off to Kim and the team to like do that well. I'm wondering, maybe this is just from me, but one other thing that's kind of still lingering for me is like, okay, if 10 million-ish is the revenue number, or this like maturity stage is the, well, I guess that's on the buy side, but if 10 million-ish in revenue is the point at which you start being interesting to strategics, there's lots of early stage investors that work for companies or founders who are building businesses and operating businesses that are significantly below that. How does that group participate in the M&A ecosystem? Do they? Should they? Like, what's your view there?
They're still, so should they be buyers? Probably not. But will they be sellers? Yes, of course they'll be sellers. They'll need to realize some version of the capital stack at some point in time. And there are definitely buyers for much smaller businesses. It's just the pool of buyers opens up when you hit those sort of those rough thresholds. And the simple maths is if you are a strategic and you bought 10 mil of revenue and you already do that same activity, that same thing, that same product, you already have that. And if I just take the telco example from my past, we were a big telco. And if we bought a little telco, we would say, well, we do what you do, but bigger. So can I do what you do, but with less people or with different resources or with resources that I've already paid for that I can apply my platform across what you already do in your business, and I can ameliorate those costs or even maybe remove those costs altogether. At 10, it's really obvious. You don't have to think too hard that there will be costs you can remove to make the business at least break even, if not profitable. At 5, you have to look much harder. You got to get the magnifying glass out. At 3, you need more than a magnifying glass, right? You need a microscope to work out what surgical changes to make to a really skinny business. There's a question of what are you buying, right? If you're buying a business that's only making a couple of million bucks of revenue and still is still run by the 2 or 3 founders and doesn't have any infrastructure about it, then you're buying the people. You're really hiring the people and maybe buying the brand, but there isn't a core there that can sustain itself. And so really my point is that at certain scale, you open up a universe of buyers that it finds it really, really hard to transact at the micro. But at the micro, there are definitely buyers for those sorts of businesses that are much, much smaller. It's just a narrower pool. So an example would be you might have a 3-4 mil revenue business and you might sell that business to a search funder. You might sell that to if you're a software business, you might sell that to a software aggregation play like a Constellation or many versions of their business model that exist. And it's a good business model, right? They make lots of money out of amalgamating much smaller tech businesses.
On that point, like a lot of the scenarios that we see come up, especially as investors, is like your portfolio company goes out to raise Series A, Series B, and just aren't able to get that away. And so then they can't fund their growth and they go, okay, well then, you know, it's either we couldn't raise, but now we either shut down or like realize that we're going to run out of money eventually, or we go and get acquired. What's your advice for like at that stage? What are they doing? Because it feels like a bit of a mess at that point. Cause it's like, oh, we tried to raise. Now we're looking for acquisition.
Yeah. Now we're a seller. I've got a few things to say. So the first is raising and selling is almost the same activity. You are selling shares. The question is, are you selling lots of shares or all the shares or many of the shares? So my encouragement would be park some of that stigma attached to raising is good and selling is bad if you're not selling for a great price, because in both instances, you're selling shares. And if you break it down into that, should you be emotive about selling some or lots? Probably not. So that would be step one. Step two would be never waste a crisis. And this is just good business advice. What have you been told? No one wants to give you any money. That's a crisis. That's a lovely opportunity to go and look really deep internally and probably cut costs really, really hard. Why would you do that? Firstly, I've never waste a crisis. But secondly, what you're going to do is you're going to buy runway. And by trimming those costs, you're going to create optionality that you might just go, this is a lovely little business that I'm just going to hold forever. And there is nothing wrong with owning the local laundromat. And I say that because actually PE thinks local laundromats are awesome at the moment and they're rolling them out everywhere and they've become this kind of the sexy. There's a whole bunch of PE laundromat rollouts happening across Sydney in particular at the moment.
We're talking about like, you know, like laundry, not like money laundering.
Not money laundering. Yeah. Just good old fashioned washing machines and dryers.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't you know, Cheryl? PE in Australia is deep on money laundering. They've identified it as a great business.
It's like the mattress store, right? Like every mattress store in the corner is actually just a money laundering.
Oh my goodness.
And so I would say go buy yourself the option to just have a great business that you can hold on to forever and park the capital story for a moment and just focus on that, because why not? And coming out of that, you'll have time. you might make some profit. You might use those profits to reinvest back into things like buying out those folks on the register that can't hold on forever. And then you might make yourself more enticing to someone else out there. But the one thing I wouldn't do is I wouldn't do the ostrich trick, right? So at that point, when you've heard the negative message of not going to give you more money, do not put your head in the sand and hope that that activity is going to lead to a better outcome than the capital markets telling you that there's no more money. So don't do the ostrich. Don't waste the crisis.
All right. Don't waste the crisis.
Amazing. I'll say, I mean, from what I've seen, those like sub $5 million sales processes, like mostly they're founder led. Mostly they are like first time ever going through a transaction. And so they are minor chaos. But I really like that of like, let's not lose sight of the fact that it's a sales process, that you have done when you're capital raising, like when you are fundraising, you're doing essentially the same thing. I think the like acqui-hire motion is slightly different. You're like selling yourself then as opposed to shares in the business, but it's a very similar motion.
Yeah, great. And remember that in that moment, you, the founder of that business, you know your market better than anyone else. Who better in your market to call the relevant strategic who's the most obvious buyer and say to them, I am for sale. It's you. You're hanging out at industry events. You're going to conferences together. You bump into each other in the hallways of those of all of those industry style events. You've been doing it for a long, long time. You probably bump up against each other in competitive processes. That's the next phone call after going and trimming costs to make sure you've got all the time in the world.
This has been so educational. We always ask people the same last question, which is, what is your biggest big cojones moment, a moment that you have felt really brave?
I'm going to go back to the GFC. So after having dusted all of my money on Rio and BHP sometime before that, during the GFC, I would have been in that transition between uni, part-time, lots of part-time jobs and full-time work. And so in that transition, I had just moved out of home or was just about to move out of home. I was saving up money. I was then renting a place. I was trying to build my own life. And I was even at sort of at the end of uni working sort of 60-hour weeks across a range of different jobs to try and make ends meet. But I was always able to pull apart about 500 bucks of spare cash. And that was the marketable parcel that I could buy through CompSec. And so what I was doing during the GFC was every time I'd get my 500 bucks out of one of those jobs and have it as spare money, having paid the rent and bought the food and done all the things I needed to do, I was putting that in the stock market. I was just averaging down as the world was coming to an end. And the reason that for me was the big kahunas moment is firstly, each of those dollars meant a lot more to me than their equivalent today. Those were food checks. Those were rent checks. And if I couldn't work the next week for whatever reason, things would have been really, really dire. So the consequence was extreme, but I also had no idea what I was doing and I had never lived through a crisis before. And so I didn't know where the crises end. I didn't know whether we would ever come back to any reference point that was more like the old days, having never seen one of those down cycles. And the pinnacle of that, I remember Macquarie Bank shares at 30 odd bucks and this is a bank, right? And I just watched banks in America collapse and looking at an Australian bank thinking, well, you're not one of the guaranteed banks. You're outside of the pillars. What will happen to you if the banking system collapses globally? Well, frankly, I have no idea, but I think you're a great business. I've learned my BHP Rio lessons. I've tried to understand what it is that you hold as a core asset outside of the headlines. And I kept buying and I kept buying all the way through to the bottom. And I was lucky enough to have the time and the patience to ride that wave on the way up. And those moments were terrifying. And whilst I didn't pick any unicorns, I just invested in great businesses. I tried to understand their fundamentals. I learned heaps of good stuff out of it. I lost an unbelievable amount of sleep through that experience. And that helped us, you know, that helped us sort of set up our life and pay for our first deposit for a place and put us in really good stead. But it was terrifying at the time.
Yeah, I can only imagine. It is incredible how counterintuitive it is to invest the bottom and sell the top.
Yep.
Like, it physically hurts.
And you've fallen in love with these things, right? You've watched these businesses through their darkest moments. You feel like you're on the journey with them. You then have no idea how much better it could be from here. And I remember selling Macquarie shares at about $100, thinking I've got to be missing the top here, right? Surely it's going to go up from here. But the hardest part is the sell, second only to the next hardest was just sitting at the bottom of the market and being prepared that if it went below that $30, we'd be buying some more.
Yep. Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex. This was really great.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you, Alex.
Founders scale faster on Deel. Set up payroll for any country in minutes, hire anyone anywhere, get visas handled fast, and get back to building. Visit deel.com/day1. That's DEEL.com/day1.